Okay, we got it recording now.
Good. As people are streaming in, I want to let people know that we have about 10 questions left over from a couple of weeks ago for Hugh. And as promised, we're going to make sure that we start this session with those questions. So we're going to give it another minute or so. It looks like we've already got about half the usual number of people coming in. And when that number rises up to a good point, then we'll start the questions for Hugh. Hugh, how was your time away when you were at the church?
Oh, it was really good there at Glenkirk. I recorded the first service to an empty audience. It's kind of strange looking out and there's nobody there. But then we did one outside, and a lot of people who watched it online said, "Hey, I want to come for the live one." So we had about a couple hundred people outside.
Yeah, it's tough to get Q&A when there's no audience.
It is, yeah. But we had a good time with the second service.
Good.
And that church wants us to do a star party, and they got a good facility for that.
Oh, good.
You know, it's all walled off. They can turn the lights off. It'll be nice and dark. So we got to be able to pull that off. That'll be a lot easier than going to that place up at 7,400 feet.
I'd still like to go to Anza Borrego sometime, like we were trying to plan before.
Oh, right. Yeah. That'd be good.
Hugh, do you think that Glenkirk would help us publicize Paradox being right there in their backyard when we get started again?
I think so. I mean, I think a lot of churches would. I know that, for example, that church, that big church in San Dimas, would promote it. It's got a new name now. I forget the name of it.
Okay.
It's called Christ Church of the Valley, but they got a new name.
Okay. Well, I think we have a good number of participants. Hugh, you ready to
I'm all set. Sure.
Field some questions. All right. The first one comes from Scott, and the question is about symmetries, how gravity and quantum mechanics can fit together. Could Hugh try to translate that in a way my puny brain can understand and tell others?
Well, in theoretical physics, symmetries is a very complex concept. I'm not even going to attempt to try to explain that in a short period of time. But I think the gist is that, you know, with the Big Bang creation model, you have the universe starting off infinitesimally small and nearly infinitely hot, but it's created with the property of ongoing expansion. So as the universe expands, it gets bigger and bigger, and it gets cooler and cooler. That's a principle of thermodynamics. Any expanding system will cool in proportion to the degree of expansion. And what happens when the universe is newly created is it's so extremely hot that all four of the four forces of physics are united into a single force. And if you want a lay explanation of how that works, think of a bar magnet. If you heat up a bar magnet, the magnetism disappears. It doesn't really disappear. What happens is the magnetic energy and the heat energy blend together to become a single source of energy. And if you cool it down the right way, it splits apart into magnetism and heat. Well, the same thing happens with the four fundamental forces of gravity, the strong nuclear force, the weak nuclear force, and the electromagnetic force. As the universe cools, gravity is the first force to separate out. So at about 10 to the minus 43 seconds is when the single united force splits into the force of gravity and the strong electroweak force. And then when the universe is about 10 to the minus 35 seconds old, the strong electroweak force splits into the strong nuclear force and the electroweak force. And then at about a 20th of a second after the cosmic creation event, the electroweak force splits into the weak nuclear force and electromagnetism. And many of you know that, that was the quest of Albert Einstein in his later years, is to actually come up with a unified field theory. And he wasn't successful mainly because at that time we lacked the experimental tools to really explore this concept of physics that arises out of Big Bang cosmology. But in the 1970s, a particle accelerator actually was capable of duplicating the energy density conditions that existed when the electromagnetic force was united with the weak nuclear force. And that's been done in several particle accelerators since then. And so we now have a complete understanding of the first step of unification. The Large Hadron Collider, which many of you are aware of, in France and Switzerland, was designed to get us partway towards where the electroweak force unites with a strong nuclear force. If you really want to go all the way, you would need a particle accelerator that is 40 trillion miles long. And so the chances of that being funded in the near future are rather remote. But thanks to the Large Hadron Collider, we've actually made some discoveries that are giving us some additional insights. And these insights tell us that the symmetries we see in gravity, general relativity, and quantum mechanics, things happen to these symmetries when the single force of physics splits into two, into three, into four forces of physics. You get what's called symmetry breaking. And so, for example, when the strong electroweak force, strong nuclear force separates itself from the electroweak force at about 10 to the minus 35 seconds, there is a symmetry breaking that is now fairly well understood, mainly because maps of the cosmic microwave background radiation, where we're able to get an accurate measure of the polarization modes of that radiation, give us insight as to what's happening when the strong electroweak force splits out. And basically, it predicts that with the symmetry breaking, the universe is going to hyper-expand. So that's called inflation, where the universe expands from the cosmic creation event. And then when the strong nuclear force separates out from the electroweak force, you get an expansion of the universe. It's very brief. It only lasts for about 10 to the minus 34 or 10 to the minus 35 seconds. But it's a period of time when the universe expands millions of times faster than the velocity of light. And I've written about this in this book. Let me see if I can pull it off the shelf here, right? Yeah, the fourth edition of The Creator and the Cosmos. I have an extensive chapter there on symmetry breaking and particularly inflation and why the symmetry breaking has to be fine-tuned to get the just right kind of inflation whereby you have the possibility of life in the universe. If the universe didn't hyperinflate at about 10 to the minus 34 to 10 to the minus 35 seconds, there'd be no possibility for life in the universe today. And if you want the details, check it out in the fourth edition of The Creator and the Cosmos. And incidentally, anyone can get a free chapter of this book. And I think it actually includes the chapter. The chapter we give away, I believe, is the chapter that deals with this inflation concept. So, and you can get that at reasons.org/Ross. I could go into more details on that, Ross, but it would get really technical. And I think people will find sufficient citations in The Creator and the Cosmos so they can go as deep as they want to go.
Thank you. I have a question from Stephen Posta. Says, according to recent scientific research, planets rich in uranium and thorium would struggle to host life. Heat from these radioactive elements in a planet's mantle cuts in half the formation of a dynamo-driven magnetic field like Earth's, which shields life from solar radiation. Is this further proof for God's fine-tuning of Earth for advanced life?
Well, that's interesting because you really need a lot of uranium and thorium in a planet in order to have sufficient heat flow lasting long enough that you can sustain a magnetic field and plate tectonics for billions of years, which is what you need if you want to have the possibility of advanced life. I've actually got three chapters on this in my next book, the book that I've just finished on a cosmic interior designs. It may wind up with a different title. It's being externally reviewed right now. So it's due out April 1st, 2022. But you'll see some articles I've written on our website under Today's New Reason to Believe, where I talk about these features. And so, but there is a problem if the heat flow is too rapid. So I think that's what this paper is referring to, is if you got a whole lot of uranium and thorium, and if the interior of the planet is designed differently than the Earth is, you're going to run into the problem. The heat will escape from the interior of the Earth at too rapid a rate, and that'll put an end to plate tectonics. You need that heat flow from the interior of the Earth out through the mantle and into the crust in order to have plate tectonics. And you particularly need to fine tune what's called the asthenosphere. That's a layer, a very thin layer that lies just below the crust of the Earth, separating the crust of the Earth from the mantle of the Earth. And in this book I've just completed, I talk about how our planet Earth has an asthenosphere that's unlike that of any other conceivable rocky planet, and it explains why our magnetic field has been stable and strong for 4 billion years, and likewise the plate tectonics. This paper that Post is referring to is making the point the heat flow can't be too slow out of the interior of the Earth, nor can it be too rapid. On the other hand, to have sufficient heat flow for a period of 4 billion years, the Earth has got to begin with a huge store of accretion heat, plus a huge store of long-lived radioisotopes, and particularly the radioisotopes uranium-232, uranium-238, and potassium-40. Those are the most important for sustaining the heat flow long enough that you can have advanced life on the planet. I'm willing to take a follow-up, Mark, if there's a follow-up to that question.
Okay, well, if it comes in, we'll deal with that later. Maz Khan has a question from a few weeks ago, and that was that angels were present when God created Adam and Eve in the world. Are angels also created in the image of God?
That's a good question. It tells us in Job 38, verse 7, that the angels were witnesses to God laying down the foundations of the earth. And that would imply that the angels were created long before we human beings were created. And of course, you've got Satan entering the Garden of Eden, which implies that he likely pre-existed God creating Adam and Eve. And, you know, the whole idea that there was a rebellion, because clearly Satan was in a rebellious state against God when he entered the garden, that could be cited as another piece of evidence that the creation of the angels long predated us. You know, the Bible only refers to us human beings as being created in the image of God. But it does tell us that the angels likewise are intelligent beings and that they're spiritual beings. You know, and that's part of the image of God, that, you know, like God, we have a spirit. And, you know, like God, we have intelligence, the capability of bonding. Like God, we can tame a lower species of life, just like he can tame us. So we have a lot in common with God, but it tells us in Hebrews chapter 1 that only Jesus Christ is the exact representation of God. We human beings are created in the image of God, but that does not mean that we are, quote, like God. And that's something about Satan. He wanted to be like God, to be like the Most High. So I would imply that he's got some of the divine attributes that we human beings don't share. The Bible tells us that the angels are higher than we are. On the other hand, it also tells us a time will come when we who are followers of Jesus Christ will be judging the angels and instructing and teaching the angels, which means there's something about the image of God that we possess that they do not possess. Exactly what that is, you know, it's hard to tell, but I think minimally what we can discern from the New Testament is that unlike the angels, we human beings directly experience the grace of God working within us. Paul makes the point that the angels are intently observing us to learn about the grace of God. And so they're trying to discover the mysteries of God's grace and the marvel of God's grace by observing how it operates within us human beings. But unlike the angels, we directly experience the grace of God, his redemptive work working within them. The fallen angels have no pathway for redemption. We fallen human beings do have a pathway for redemption. Thanks to the work of Christ, thanks too to the fact that unlike the angels, we can experience physical death, and the physical death of the creator of the universe can redeem us from our sin and evil. So I think that's one reason why we will eventually be put above the angels. So this whole concept of the image of God is a complex subject, but I take the position that angels possess some of this image. We possess some of this image, and it's different, the part that we possess from the angels possess. And we'll discover what it's all about when we get into the new creation. Right now, we're looking through a glass darkly.
That leads to another question, and it was by Aaron, who asked, how can God, who is all-loving, etc., have the capacity to create Satan, who is evil?
Well, it tells us in the Bible that one of God's motivations for creating was to magnify the expression of his love. And therefore, he created beings with free will. Love is impossible unless you have free will, a capacity to submit and enjoy a relationship or to reject it. And what I find interesting is that God granted both the angels and us human beings not what I would just call free will, but strong free will, which means he's given us an enormous amount of freedom to think whatever we want to think, to say what we ever want to say, and do what we want to do. And he's given us the powers to express our free will in very strong ways. And what I've come to realize is that's because God's intent is to have strong love relationships with us. And you can't have a strong love relationship unless we are created with strong free will. I mean, God could have created us with much more restrictions on the expression of our free will. But that would kind of move us in the direction of being more robotic in our relationships with one another and with God. And that was not God's intent. He wanted strong, fulfilling, intimate, emotional, spiritual, loving relationships with us, which meant he had to take the risk of granting strong free will, knowing ahead of time that if he gave the angels and us human beings strong free will, many of us would choose to reject him rather than to enter into a relationship with him. But he was okay with a large percentage of the human species and the angelic species rejecting him in order that he could really experience this strong free will relationship with those angels and those human beings that choose to accept him. And again, this is part of the mystery of the gospel, part of the mystery of why God created, why he did things the way he did, part of the mystery of God's grace. And we see a little bit of it now. We'll understand a lot more later. But it's amazing how much God has revealed to us through the Bible about his motivations and the benefits that we can possibly accrue from why God created things the way he did.
Keith Wilson in New Zealand asks, some time ago I read the book Four Views on Creation, Evolution, and Intelligent Design, where I, Keith Wilson, thought that you and Steve Myers outstripped the arguments of Ham and Deborah Hasma. In reading your books and Steve's, it seems to me that you two are quite close, especially when compared with BioLogos. Is this a fair assessment, and are there any crucial differences?
That is a fair assessment. And, you know, having participated in that book, the way the book was organized, all of us were to write a 10,000 word essay, basically making a positive case for a position. We were told to make a positive case for a position and to really not say much about critiquing the other positions. Why? Because after we wrote our 10,000 word piece, we would each have an opportunity to critique the other three views. And then we'd also have an opportunity to respond to the critiques. That's the way it was set up. But I remember reading Steve's piece that he initially submitted. And I said, you know, what you're basically doing here is explaining the position of the Discovery Institute. And the book actually had to be retitled. The book originally was titled Creation, Evolution, and Genesis. But because Steve Meyer is the president of the Discovery Institute, their position is we're not going to address biblical issues. Our whole focus is looking at the science and establishing that some kind of intelligent designer exists. And if you're aware of the Discovery Institute, they're not all Christians. It's a coalition of people who would agree that there is intelligent design that implies an intelligent designer, but they're not all in agreement that is Jesus Christ. And they also have the view that if we're going to actually make headway in the public secular arena, we have to avoid any association with Christianity and the Bible, mainly because of what I see as their misunderstanding of First Amendment, that if you actually look at the Supreme Court, it is true in 1987, the Supreme Court ruled that creationism could not be taught in the public education arena. However, if you read carefully the Supreme Court proceedings, and incidentally, they're now totally public domain. Anyone can read them. And in a book I wrote on this, it was More Than a Theory. I actually gave you the links where you could actually read those Supreme Court proceedings for yourself. And what you notice is they said, any view of creation or evolution is acceptable in the public education arena if it has some demonstrable scientific merit or integrity. And they ruled against creationism, which they defined as young earth creationism, because it brought in a number of witnesses, and the witnesses basically declared this has zero scientific merit. And they said, well, if it's got zero scientific merit, then we got a problem, because the only way we can justify this being in the public education system is we're basically sustaining one particular denomination or sect within Christianity against all others. And they said that violates the Constitution. This is a long ramble, just making the point that I basically said in my response to Steve Meyer, we all know where the Discovery Institute stands, and we know why, consequently, you are not willing to discuss Genesis or the Bible or this scientific evidence for a creator. But tell us where you stand. And in his response, he was quite forthcoming in explaining his own personal position. And he actually thanked me for giving him the opportunity to explain where he personally stands, because he is a Christian and he wants to promote the Christian faith. But as the president of the Discovery Institute, he is bound basically just to defend the evidence for intelligent design. But frankly, I think if we have a correct understanding of what the Supreme Court ruled, we have realized we don't have to worry about identifying the intelligent designer. That's perfectly legal to do in the public education arena, providing you can back it up with some demonstrable scientific evidence. And a good example of that is Big Bang cosmology. Big Bang cosmology is taught in the public education system at all educational levels, for the simple reason there is strong scientific evidence for it. And yes, it does imply that the God of the Bible created the universe, but you can't deny the scientific evidence. So the fact that that's already in the public education arena means we shouldn't be afraid of identifying who the intelligent designer is. And that's kind of the distinction. We had reasons to believe have been doing intelligent design research a good 15 years before the Discovery Institute even existed. But we've always done it in the context of identifying the intelligent designer. In fact, we would argue it's hard to make a case for intelligent design if you don't identify who the intelligent designer is. Moreover, if you don't identify the intelligent designer, it raises suspicion in the scientific community. And that's something you see as a critique of the Discovery Institute. A lot of secular scientists have said, this is simply creationism dressed up in a cheap tuxedo. That's a quote that's been widely used throughout the scientific literature, mainly because the Discovery Institute, at least right now, is not willing to divorce themselves from young Earth creationism. And therefore, they're saying, hey, we already ruled against this in 1987. Why are we permitting the Discovery Institute to do and say the things they are? But I can tell you from the people I know personally at the Discovery Institute, the vast majority are not young Earth creationists. They're old Earth creationists, and the vast majority are Christians. I think it's time that they get a little more public about where they're coming from, because I see no danger from the Supreme Court ruling.
Do we have a few more questions? It's 10:55 or so. Do you want me to just go through those last few questions and then let you move into your webinar? Or how do you feel about that?
Well, tell you what, why don't you give me one of the shorter of the three last questions? We'll save the next two for next week.
Okay.
Getting a little late, and I'd like to jump into the teaching. We'll have time for Q&A after I'm done with my 30 minutes of teaching.
Okay. The last question that we'll do today from the holdover is referring to the angel of death that killed all the firstborn in Egypt. What does he do all the rest of the time? Was he created for that one event, or does he have other duties and responsibilities?
That's a great question. And my answer is, I have no idea. I don't know. Like all of us, we've got more than one job description. So I would expect that that was not his only reason for being created. I don't see anything in scripture that gives us an indication. People have speculated that that angel of death was also involved in other judgments by God, like the flood or what happened in Sodom and Gomorrah. But that is speculation. We just don't know. Or at least that's my position. I don't know. So hope you're okay with that.
Okay. We'll leave it with that. And if you open us with a prayer and then move into your webinar, we'd be ready.
That'd be great. Father in heaven, we thank you for this Sunday that we have to focus on what you've revealed to us in the book of scripture and the book of nature. So Father, I pray that you would encourage all of us to open up our spirit, to receive more from you, more of your love, life, and truth, greater understanding. I pray you would bless our discussion time with one another later on in this meeting. In Jesus' name, amen. Give me a minute here. The pollen count's a little bit high here. With spring here in Southern California, but hopefully that'll be the last time. Okay, let me share screen here so that you can all see my visuals. Here we go. All right. Again, this is just a reminder that I do take questions on Facebook and Twitter. And hey, if you're not already a subscriber to the Reasons to Believe YouTube channel, please take advantage of that. You can go to YouTube, Reasons to Believe, and they'll show you how to do that. And this next slide, this is the address we're going to need to get into our web meeting. That's how we've been designing these for the last several Sundays. Start with a webinar, then we go into a web meeting. Where we can actually engage one another, discuss things with our cameras on and our microphones on. But 2 weeks ago, when I was with you, to say, where was I last week? Well, Mark was teaching last week on fallacies. And last week, I was teaching on how we can get to know God through nature at the Glenkirk Church, which is in Glendora. And the message is posted. So if you want to check that out, it was a 25-minute message I gave. And it's now posted on the Glenkirk site. If you go to Glenkirk Church YouTube, you'll be able to find it. And 2 weeks ago, I briefly mentioned one of the more astounding breakthrough discoveries in science, in the book of nature, were these optical atomic clocks. And as you look at this amazing instrument, you notice that it's got webbing and you can see wires going everywhere. This takes me back when I was an undergraduate student working in an atomic spectroscopy lab at the University of British Columbia, where we had to machine all the parts for the new instruments that we were designing. And you see that in this photograph as well. Virtually everything you've seen here was machined in one of the shops in the physics department at these facilities. And you can see some of that there. Very complicated instrument, but the physicists actually built this all on their own. And this is a strontium 87 atomic optical clock. It's housed at the Joint Institute for Laboratory Astrophysics in Boulder, Colorado. And you're wondering about atomic clocks. Atomic clocks tick rate is determined by the frequency of light when an atom changes from one energy state to another. So, you know, if an electron bumps up an energy level, then you get this frequency of light. And so that's what this atomic clock is measuring. And the optical clocks are measuring at much higher frequencies. So potentially there's superior atomic clocks to cesium clocks. So for example, an optical atomic clock runs at an optical frequency, and the best optical atomic clock gains or loses less than 1 second over the entire age of the universe, which means it's got a timing precision of one part in 10 to the 18th, or one part in one quintillion. You say, how does that compare with the best clocks we have today? Well, the best clocks that are used for timekeeping today are what are called cesium atomic clocks. And so there's a couple of cesium atomic clocks that are basically the time standard that are used in different facilities around the world. But these optical atomic clocks, they are capable of keeping time 100 times more better than the best cesium atomic clock. However, in order to replace cesium atomic clocks as the best timekeeping instruments, physicists first have to prove the reproducibility of optical atomic clock measurements through a series of clock comparisons. That was done more than a decade ago with cesium atomic clocks, where they took different cesium atomic clocks at different locations, then compared their frequencies through clock comparisons, basically demonstrating, hey, this is reproducible. One cesium atomic clock is going to give us the same results as another cesium atomic clock. And so the problem was it was difficult to come up with a technology to actually compare different atomic clocks. And to really make this work, you want optical atomic clocks that are based on different frequencies, based on different atoms. And so, however, what we noticed was in Boulder is that we had two different facilities, atomic physics facilities, that had in total three different optical atomic clocks. So they spent years trying to come up with the mechanism whereby they could actually compare the clocks and see if it's actually possible to replace cesium atomic clocks with optical atomic clocks. Now, let me just give you a quick point here. You say, why are you talking all about these atomic clocks? They're crucial for establishing cosmic and particle creation models. That's why I'm spending time on this. This is why I got an article coming out on this, because this is a major breakthrough that's going to dramatically increase the evidence we have for the biblical accounts of creation, particularly cosmic creation, and a lot of other applications too, which I'll review in a minute. But I want to show you how it was that these clock comparisons were achieved, whereby a pathway was opened up where we could actually replace cesium atomic clocks with these new clocks that are 100 times better in their timekeeping precision. So this next image basically shows you how it was that, and this is, they actually formed a network from these two different facilities, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, which is in Boulder, and the Joint Institute for Laboratory Astrophysics, which is also in Boulder. And they're separated by about a kilometer and a half. So these two different sets of atomic clocks are in two different buildings, separated by about a mile and a half. The National Institute of Standards and Technology, they have an aluminum 27 optical atomic clock and a yttrium 171 optical atomic clock. And then you have the Joint Institute for Laboratory Astrophysics. They had the strontium 87 atomic clock. And they found two different ways to link the clocks together. One was basically a laser communication. So that's what's called the free space link that you see here. They basically just shot laser beam from one facility to the facility a kilometer and a half away. And then they use a fiber optic link that connected the two facilities that had already been in place. They didn't have to build that. So they're able to use that fiber optic link to compare these two distantly separated clocks, and then also to use a free space link through a laser beam. And in both cases, they're able to compare the clocks and by these two independent methods show that indeed these optical atomic clocks are reliable and stable, which means we really can replace our cesium atomic clocks with these optical atomic clocks. And this is going to be fantastic for basic physics, astrophysics, and for developing creation models and proving to a far greater degree than what the Bible states about creation is true. So with that, I'm going to briefly review for you some of the applications that we can get from these atomic clocks. And the first set of applications is in the category of global positioning satellites. You're well aware that we have these GPS navigation systems, and it's based on these orbiting satellites that are orbiting about 22,000 miles above the Earth, which means when they're at that distance, they stay put relative to the Earth. And so, these satellites, what makes these satellites effective and actually being able to do navigation positioning, the greater the clock accuracy, the greater the precision of this global positioning satellite. And right now, using cesium atomic clocks, our GPS navigation system is such that they can tell where you are or where your car is to within 10 meters. And so you notice if you got a GPS navigation system in your automobile, it can tell you what highway you're on, but it's not able to tell what lane you're in on the highway. With 10 meters, it doesn't really know whether you're in the carpool lane or you're in the slow lane or the fast lane. It simply knows you're on the highway. And there's a parallel road to the highway. You probably notice that your GPS system sometimes gets confused and thinks, hey, you're not on the freeway. You're on the road that's adjacent to the freeway. And that's because of the fact that it's only able to tell where you are to within about 10 meters to within about 30 feet. However, with these optical atomic clocks, they'll now be able to tell where you are to within 1 centimeter. It means not only will the GPS system know what lane you're in on the freeway or the highway, they'll be able to tell if your car is drifting slightly towards the next adjacent lane. And so this GPS system is now will be so precise, you won't need a driver for the vehicle. You've probably heard of driverless vehicles. It requires a much more precise GPS system we have today. But with this breakthrough on optical atomic clocks, it'll actually be able to tell where your car is to within 1 centimeter precision, which means that not only will it be possible to have your computers basically driving your car for you, you won't have to be behind the wheel. You can just be sitting in the car enjoying conversation with the other passengers, or you could be working on your computer or talking on the phone. The navigation system does all the driving for you. And because it can do it to within 1 centimeter precision, that now means we can make the lanes on the highway narrower. And so, for example, it'd be easy to transform a 4-lane highway into a 6-lane highway, which means without making any change in our freeways or road system, we can have a lot more cars on the road moving at much higher speeds. Why? Because if you can actually do things to within 1 centimeter precision, that means that the system's going to know how far the next car is from you, in front of you, and back of you. And if you've got the same system controlling all these vehicles, it can make sure we're all running at the same velocity. And if you need to move, for instance, so you could have one lane that's faster than the other, and as you need to go off the highway, you can move off. This all can be controlled automatically. At a minimum, computer simulations have shown is that you can get to your destination a lot faster than you can now. Speed limits could be raised, for example, and the flow through traffic would be at least double, which means you can move twice as many cars on the highway that you can move today without putting any new lanes. What it would be bad for collision companies, because now there would be no traffic accidents. There'd be no collisions taking place. But that'd be good news for all of us who have auto insurance. It means you wouldn't need auto insurance anymore since there's no possibility for crashes or accidents. We don't need to have insurance. And you know, a lot of us pay quite a bit to have the automobile insurance, especially if you've got more than one vehicle or if you've got one of these expensive vehicles. So eliminating automobile insurance would be a huge boost to the economy. It also means your cars would last longer because they're not going to be experiencing macro damage or micro damage. I mean, this thing could actually be designed to help you in dust storms, for example, to minimize damage to your vehicle. So your cars are going to last a lot longer. Now, a lot of people have been concerned. Well, isn't it true that a lot of people have a job driving trucks or buses or they're, driving trains? I mean, this could be used for trains. You don't need a driver for a train anymore. You might need one for a subway because the GPS system isn't going to work underground, but you'd be able to eliminate all the truck drivers and bus drivers, taxi drivers, Uber and Lyft drivers, that could all be eliminated. You know, I know a lot of people are worried, okay, if I get an Uber or Lyft, I mean, how do I know I can trust the individual behind the wheel? But if there's nobody behind the wheel, that basically eliminates the possibility of crime. And a lot of Uber and Lyft drivers have got the same worry. You know, who knows the passenger I pick up? The passenger I pick up might try to rob me or do physical harm to me. Well, so this is going to greatly reduce crime. It's going to mean that all those truck drivers and bus and train drivers can now be redeployed to more productive work. And so I think if, for those that are worried, hey, we're going to throw people out of work, let's just go back a few decades, actually quite a few decades, when all the elevators required an elevator operator. And with elevator technology, we didn't need elevator operators anymore. And all those elevator operators could be retrained to do much more productive work. And that's actually been the driving force of advancing technology, taking people out of mundane, repetitive work and setting them free to do work that's more enjoyable, more productive, and puts more money in their pocket. Okay, what about search and rescue? You know, if I fall in some mountainous area and I've got my cell phone on me, they're going to be able to pin down my location to plus or minus 10 meters. But that could still make it difficult for search and rescue. And particularly, for example, if an animal that's got a chip in it, you know, most people put a chip in their pet in case they get lost, you can figure out where they are. Well, what if your pet was to fall down some kind of a chimney or into a pipe? But you got plus or minus 10 meter precision, that's not going to be that helpful. But if it's plus or minus 1 centimeter, you're going to know exactly where that lost hiker is, or that lost pet, or any lost item. I mean, this means we can now put chips on all kinds of expensive instruments, valuable instruments we want to keep track of. We're going to know where they are to within 1 centimeter. And, you know, if you ever lost something, it'd be wonderful to say, okay, where in the house did I leave that thing? Well, it's plus or minus 10 meters. It might take you a few hours to find that item. But if you got it down to plus or minus 1 centimeter, it'll only tell you what drawer it is in your closet. It'll tell you exactly where in the drawer that is. So it's a great way for tracking valuables, for tracking data storage devices. I mean, I don't know about you, but I got all these flash drives I have that I use for transferring data, and sometimes I lose them. It'd be wonderful just to have a little chip put into one of these things. So if I lose them, I can find out exactly where they are. But the paper in which this was published, they basically made the point, you know, we're all concerned about climate change. With these new optical atomic clocks, we're going to be able to actually measure the rise of sea level to within 1 centimeter precision. And we're all worried what's happening to the Antarctic ice cap, what's happening to the ice over Greenland, or for matter, what's happening to the ice fields and the Canada and Iceland and other parts of the world. We can use this GPS tracking system to, and we can use ground-based systems. I mean, this is going to be a new breakthrough for, what do you call it, when you're making measurements in the ground at the height of a mountain. I forget the term for it, but you're now going to be able to make those measurements to 1 centimeter precision. So it's actually going to be able to help us develop more reliable and accurate climate change models than we have today. And we're actually going to be able to track plate tectonic moves to much higher precision, basically, and see new repeated measurements. You can actually get the precision down to plus or minus 1 millimeter. And so being able to measure the movement of continental plates, this could be used to track earthquakes. In fact, there's actually the potential we could come up with a much superior earthquake prediction system. So these are just the GPS applications. What about the creation model tests? Well, one of the things, you know, when I was an undergraduate student, we were actually looking into in radio astronomy. I got into radio astronomy when I was in my junior year as an undergraduate, and I took a job in the summertime working at the Dominion Radio Observatory in Penticton, British Columbia. And I was with a team there that was basically saying, you know, it's actually possible that we could link together radio telescopes thousands of miles apart and actually come up with a telescope with a resolving power of not just an instrument that's got a 150 feet diameter dish, but an instrument that has the equivalent diameter of, say, 2,000 or 3,000 miles. And so in Canada, they had one radio telescope in northeastern Ontario, and they had another one in this desert location of British Columbia. And they said, let's see if we can link these together and do interferometry and actually come up with an extremely high resolution telescope. They actually came up with the idea when I was a junior undergraduate, but they said, we don't have clocks sufficiently accurate to pull this off. They were looking at clocks that had a timing capability, precision of about one part in a trillion, a little bit below that. And they said, we need to be at least one part in 10 to the 13 to pull this off. Well, they finally found a couple of clocks that had that degree of precision. And they put one of those clocks in Penticton, British Columbia, another one at the Algonquin Radio Observatory. And it was in early 1967. They pulled off the world's first long baseline interferometry experiment. And I arrived at Penticton when they were about to do the second one. And the second one failed because of an instrument problem at both sites. And it was shortly thereafter that a US long baseline interferometry got up and running. Well, today, this is now routine. We have about 20 radio telescopes around the world that are being linked together in different ways to do this long baseline interferometry. But it's still true, the fundamental limiting factor are the clocks. With more accurate clocks, we can get more accurate resolution. And with more accurate resolution, we can get more accurate astronomical distances. We can get superior maps of galaxies. There's all this to be done at radio wavelengths, but with these new clocks, we can actually do this long baseline interferometry at millimeter wavelengths. Right now, the clock precision isn't adequate to do that, but with these new clocks, it will be. This means we're going to get much more accurate maps of galaxies all over the universe, and in particular, to get more accurate maps of black holes. And you've probably heard that a little less than 2 years ago, astronomers published the first ever map of the event horizon of the black hole in the center of the super galaxy M87 in the Virgo cluster. And they're trying to get a map of the event horizon in our black hole. But with these new clocks, we're going to get some really good maps of these event horizons. And that means we're going to actually be able to probe quantum gravity physics. This is important because quantum gravity refers to that very early era of the universe when there was only one unified force, which we talked about in the Q&A time. And are saying that's an early era of the universe, the first 10 to the minus 43 seconds, when the effects of quantum mechanics begin to compete with gravity for structuring the dynamics of the universe. And a number of atheist astrophysicists have speculated that maybe in the quantum gravity era, we could have a violation of the space-time theorems. And maybe there is no creation of space and time. And, but it's all speculation because we don't have instruments powerful enough to tell us what's going on in the quantum gravity era. However, a number of physicists have pointed out if we can get high precision maps of the event horizons of black holes, supermassive black holes, that'll actually tell us what's going on inside the black hole and will actually give us insights into quantum gravity. By the way, this is just one tool that astrophysicists have come up with for probing quantum gravity. Another one is to look at the images of distant quasars and blazars at short wavelengths. Because if there's high quantum space-time fluctuations in the quantum gravity era, and the significance of that, these speculations that are attempting to bypass the conclusions of the space-time theorems, namely that not only is the universe created, but even the space-time dimensions of the universe are created at the Big Bang creation event. So those speculations critically depend on there being very large quantum space-time fluctuations in the quantum gravity era. And already our observations of distant quasars and blazars put a limit on that and tell us because of the quantum space-time fluctuations are large in the quantum gravity era, as light travels from a distant quasar or blazar to our telescope, those quantum gravity effects get magnified and it has the effect of blurring the image of these distant quasars and blazars. And so far, we astronomers have seen no blurring of those images. However, if we can get high precision maps of these distant galaxies, that's actually going to help us put greater limits on this. Likewise, if we can get superior maps of black hole event horizons. So this has the potential of greatly strengthening the biblical case for cosmic creation. It's already extremely strong. 100% of the observational evidence establishes that indeed the universe has a beginning, just like the Bible describes. However, there's always regions of ignorance, but these new tools, these clocks, are going to actually push back the envelope and get us deeper and deeper and give us a more complete understanding of the universe. And I'm predicting this is simply going to strengthen the scientific case for the creation model. And actually, I've been talking to atheist physicists making the point, you know, if we continue to see that the more we learn about the universe, the more deeply we probe into unknown physics, that which each probe, we get a stronger case for the Christian faith. Don't you think you should seriously take the claims of the Bible that it makes on your life? So that's why I'm excited about these clocks. A factor of 100 improvement is going to be enormous and basically helping us make the case for the inerrancy of the Bible and what it says about cosmic creation. But something that was actually in the paper, I said already, just doing these clock comparisons, because using three different optical atomic clocks, strontium-87, aluminum-27, and yttrium, I think it was 171. The fact that we got three different frequencies meant that just in the comparisons themselves, they were able to establish limits on dark, the properties of what we call dark matter. Two kinds of matter, ordinary matter, which is made up of protons, neutrons, and electrons, that strongly interact with photons. Then we've got dark matter that does not strongly interact with photons, some of them not at all. And we already know from gravitational measurements in the universe that there's about 5.5 times as much dark matter as there is ordinary matter. But because of how weakly dark matter interacts with photons, it's extremely difficult to detect and measure the properties of dark matter. But the Bacon team, team in Boulder, Colorado, said already, just through these clock comparisons, we were able to establish that if there is some kind of interaction going on between ordinary and dark matter, it would affect the relative frequencies of these three different optical atomic clocks. And we couldn't see any effect. This actually established a limit on possible interactions between dark matter and ordinary matter that was at least a factor of 10 lower than what had been done before. So already the Bacon team has established a 10 times lower interaction level than we've done before. But they said we can do much better than that. We can at least get another factor of 10 there and maybe even be able to detect a weak interaction between ordinary and dark matter that would tell us what kind of particles they're made up of. And then they also pointed out in their paper that you can use these superior clocks to make measurements of the pulse frequencies of binary pulsars. They say, what's a binary pulsar? Is two neutron stars closely orbiting one another, or both of the neutron stars is a pulsar, where they rotate so rapidly that they're actually sending. It's kind of like a lighthouse. You know, light is a rotating light, and so you see this pulse as it goes by you every time. With pulsars, with these neutron stars, you get a pulse of radiation aimed at you, sometimes every few milliseconds, to every several seconds. And but if you've got two neutron stars orbiting one another, the theory of general relativity predicts that there's going to be a loss of gravitational energy, and it's actually going to cause the two neutron stars to basically spiral in towards one another and merge and become a black hole. In fact, astrophysicists have actually observed the merger of two neutron stars to become a black hole. That's now been observed twice. But you can look at an ongoing binary neutron star and actually measure how rapidly they're spiraling in towards one another. And that actually yields the most precise test of general relativity. And for example, papers have already been published using existing atomic clocks where they said we've been able to prove that general relativity reliably predicts the dynamics, the movement of bodies in the universe to 15 places of the decimal. So these new clocks, we can push that to 17 places of the decimal. So it has the possibility of being established to an even greater level, the reliability of general relativity to describe the dynamics of the universe. And that is the foundation of the space-time theorems. And has a lot more applications with respect to creation as well. And these same atomic clocks can be used to measure the constancy of the laws of physics, again, to another factor of 100. This is significant because several places in the Bible tells us that when God created the universe, he created it with fixed laws of physics. And using these clocks, we can measure the fixity or the constancy of these laws of physics all over the universe. And all over the universe means we can measure them all the way back in time. Atomic clocks have been used to measure the constancy of the laws of physics as far away as 13.2 billion light years, which means we're actually establishing the constancy of physics over the past 13.2 billion years. So this is a way of pushing that even further. And a number of Christian astrophysicists said, well, you know, we may actually discover new constants of physics. In fact, they're saying if we find that we do see some lack of constancy, rather than that violating what the Bible says, it could actually be exposing that there's a law of physics we've not yet discovered. Most physicists think that's probably not going to be the case, but it could be at a very subtle level. And probably one place we're going to find that is with dark energy, because the measurements of the dark energy constant tells us that it seems more and more that it's governed by two constants rather than one constant. And again, these atomic clocks can be used to help to resolve that issue and see what's going on there. Well, I've used up almost a half hour here. I'm going to quickly give an introduction to where we're going to be going next week. And, you know, last time I was with you, we looked at our study on dual revelation, and we ended with these quotes. And these are all quotes from scientists who are not theists. Miles Eldridge is a well-known atheist. In fact, he wrote this book promoting atheism and attacking creationism, titled The Triumph of Evolution and the Failure of Creationism. However, you read his book, he's really going after young earth creationism, not the old earth creationist Bibles that we see, in my opinion, explicitly taught in the Bible. However, on page 35 to 36, he made this remarkable statement about the origin of life. He said, one of the most arresting facts that I've ever learned is that in the very oldest rocks that stand a chance of showing signs of life, we find these signs. And he concludes that life must be intrinsic to the earth. In other words, he says there must be some hidden law of physics that explains why life originates on the earth immediately upon conditions, upon the conditions where you get liquid water and solid rocks, making possible the origin of life. It happens immediately, as opposed to saying, hey, if it happens immediately, the moment it can take place, maybe there's a creator performing a miracle to put it here on planet Earth. And we talked about that 2 weeks ago. I would look at the origin of life, the first appearance of animals, the Avalon explosion of animals, and then the Cambrian explosion of animals, where we see for the first time animals with internal organs, a circulatory system, a brain, a digestive tract, etc. And these are a couple of comments. This one is from Richard Dawkins, a very outspoken atheist biologist. And what he says about the Cambrian explosion, he says, quote, the Cambrian strata of rocks, vintage about 600 million years ago, are the oldest ones in which we find most of the major invertebrate groups. And we find many of them already in an advanced state of evolution. The very first time they appear, it is as though they were just planted there without any evolutionary history. And what he didn't talk about, the blind watchmaker, is it happens the moment the oxygen content suddenly jumps up from 1% to 8%. 8% is the minimum you need to have something besides microbes, but the instant it jumps up to 8%, we immediately have animals all over the earth, some of them as large as 2 meters across. But these are animals without these complex internal organisms, because there's only 8% oxygen. Those creatures are driven to extinction and they're replaced by another set of animals, but the extinction event happened as a direct result of the oxygen content jumping from 8% to 10%. At 10%, it's now possible to have a digestive tract. You can have a brain, you can have eyes, you can have a circulatory system. And this is what Richard Dawkins was referring to. But he wasn't alone. We have Gregory Ray writing in The American Zoologist, who makes the comment that the Cameron explosion of body plans is perhaps the single most striking feature of the metazoan fossil record, referring to creatures bigger than microbes. The rapidity with which phyla and classes appeared during the early Paleozoic, coupled with much lower rates of appearance for higher taxa since, poses an outstanding problem for macroevolution. And Gregory Ray and Richard Dawkins were writing when the Cambrian explosion was revealing the sudden appearance of all these invertebrate animals, all showing up 543 million years ago. Ongoing digs at these fossil sites now reveal it's not just the invertebrates. The vertebrates also show up at the same time. In fact, the phyla to which we humans belong was there right at the base of the Cambrian explosion, where more than 30 phyla of life has showed up, and we actually have fewer phyla of life on the planet today than what existed during the Cambrian explosion. And Kevin Peterson wrote an extensive review on the Cambrian explosion in which he said, elucidating the materialistic basis for the Cambrian explosion has become more elusive, not less, the more we know about the event itself. Basically making the point that a biblical perspective on the origin of history of life becomes more strongly supported by the scientific evidence the more we learn about the history of life on planet Earth. The more we learn, the more evidence we get against a naturalistic explanation, and the stronger the evidence is for at least some supernatural intervention. Now, in my book, Improbable Planet, I actually cite four more evolutionary biologists commenting on the Avalon and Cameron explosions. And again, you can get a free chapter of this book at reasons.org/Ross. But where I want to take us next week is making the point, it's not just a scientific record that gives us evidence that there's a supernatural creator intervening in the origin and history of life. It's also stated in scripture. And so this is really making the point that there really are two books, the book of nature and the book of scripture. They overlap, not entirely, as we've been talking about in the past. We see moderate concordism, not hard concordism, not minimal concordism, but this is part of the evidence we see for that particular model. And so the heavens proclaim the God's righteousness, and all the peoples see his glory. And so what we're going to be looking at next week is exactly how much science and creation content is in the Bible. As you know, I've been talking about how this has been a debate. It's a debate that's well revealed in this book we were talking about in the Q&A time, Four Views on Evolution, Creation, and Intelligent Design, where the individual defending evolutionary creationism was basically making the point that there is very little, if any, science and creation content in the Bible. So we'll address that question next week. And with that, well, let me just jump ahead here and get us. Here we go. Whoops, let me pull this back. Yeah, this will be the address we're going to need to get into the Zoom meeting. I'm going to take some questions now. However, Mark and Ross, around about, say, 11:55, I'd like us to move into our Zoom meeting where I got some questions for all of us to dialogue with and discuss. And I'll put up this address again just before we go into that Zoom meeting. So that, let me stop the share feature and turn it back over to you, Mark and Ross.
Hugh, thank you for your presence. We have a question from Scott Hankinson. He says, in Genesis 1:14, the term year is used. Since there's a Hebrew term for year, which is Shana, wouldn't it have made sense the translator would have used it in place of Yom in some instances regarding time?
Yeah, well, the reason, okay, that's a good question. And in my opinion, the reason why it doesn't use the word year is that word is specific to, you know, 365 and a quarter days. The advantage of using the word yom is it can be used for an indeterminate long period of time. It can only be used for a finite period of time. It can't be used for an infinite time, but it can be used for different passages of time. And this is something I've noticed, excuse me, in looking at the six creation days in Genesis 1, they all have different durations. I mean, to kind of give you a rough look at this, as you go from creation day 1 to creation day 6, the time periods for the first creation day compared to the second, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth, they get shorter with each successive day. I mean, it looks like creation day 1 is roughly a billion years, whereas creation day 6, for example, is on the order of 50 to 60 million years. And therefore, I see the reason why God chose to give us the word, Hebrew word yom, rather than the word for year. And what you see in Genesis 1:14, it's comparing seasons, days, and years. It's basically making the point that God made the sun, moon, and stars visible in the sky to creatures on the surface of the earth for the first time in creation day 4, so that they could look up at the sun, moon, and stars, see their positions in the sky, and actually be able to determine seasons, days, and years, and by that means regulate their biological clocks. Notice that animals don't show up until creation day 5. By the way, that's consistent with what we see in the fossil record with the Avalon and Cameron explosions. But animals are creatures that need to regulate their biological clocks by establishing the position of the sun, moon, and stars in the sky and say, well, what was going on before creation day 4? Before creation day 4, light from the sun, moon, and stars was coming in through to the atmosphere, to the surface of the earth, but the atmosphere was way too hazy to allow creatures on the surface of the earth to see where the sun, moon, and stars are in the sky. And I've written a blog on this. In fact, you can go to our new website and just put into the creation or in the search engine, day 4, it'll pop up an article I wrote where I talk about an experiment that physicists conducted where they took the composition of the Earth's atmosphere and varied the oxygen content. And you take it from less than 1% up to 8%, the atmosphere gets transformed from being extremely hazy to being transparent. You can actually do that experiment in the lab. And indeed, when it's less than 1%, there's no way creatures on the surface of the Earth are going to be able to see the sun, moon, and stars are in the sky.
Thank you, Hugh. Our friend Mark Durham here in the LA area asks, Dr. Ross, can you please comment on the personality testing program known as Enneagram? Some people see it as evil, but it appears to me to be only a test.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that. I mean, Mark, you may be familiar with it, or Ross, or me. We could just have Mark come in. I don't mind making Mark a co-host if he could tell us what's going on with that. All kinds of personality tests are out there. I had to take a personality test when I entered as an undergraduate at the University of British Columbia. That was a time where in the physics department, they were failing half the students every year. And because of that rigor, they wanted to make sure that I was psychologically balanced enough to be able to withstand that stress. So I wound up taking a number of personality tests during that day, as well as aptitude tests to ensure that I was competent enough to take these physics courses. So this sounds like another personality test, but it's one I haven't heard of. But I'd be more than happy to, let's see if I can find Mark. Yeah, here he is.
Well, Hugh, I know a little bit about it because
I'm happy to let Mark comment on it too. Go for it, Ross.
The two things that I know about it is that it has its roots in New Age. So that's a reason to not trust it right from the beginning. And I think even more compelling than that is the categories that are used were not derived by any personality or psychology testing. It was just made up by the person who came up with it. So it's, in a, you know, it's, it doesn't really relate to psychology at best, and at worst, it, since it's based in, it was founded and developed by people in the New Age, I would probably stay away from it.
Well, Ross, let me ask you a question. For example, we know in Scientology that one of the ways they recruit people is by having them take a personality test. I'm wondering if this personality test that Mark Durham is talking about is in the same category as a personality test that they use in Scientology. What do you know about that?
I don't know about that. I know that you're right about Scientology, but I don't know that it has a connection to Enneagram.
Okay. Well, I would agree.
I think
with
there's
you.
Some better.
You've got to be really careful about these tests and what the motivations are. And so if it's right. One thing to pull out what aptitudes you have, I'm okay with that. If it's trying to figure out whether you got schizophrenia, I'm okay with that. I could talk to my son. My younger son is just a couple of weeks away from getting his doctorate in neuroclinical psychology. And he administers these tests all the time to test patients for whether or not they've got different kinds of dementia or brain injury or some genetic brain disorder that doesn't make it possible for them to function. And what he tells me is that, you know, really good tests to determine if there's some psychological abnormality that you have that's treatable, typically takes 4 hours of testing by someone who has a doctorate in neuroclinical psychology. So these things that you take online, or they ask you a few questions, that's probably not going to do you much good.
Thank you, Dr. Ross. Our friend Karina Malko has a question. She says, will these new measurements that are possible with the optical atomic clocks finally put an end to the MOND models that claim there is no dark matter and that the CMB is produced by primitive cosmic dust? Thank you for your presentation.
Well, that's a great question from Karina. And yes, it's really going to help us there's literally hundreds of papers contrasting Big Bang cosmology with what's called modified Newtonian dynamics. That's what MOND stands for, modified Newtonian dynamics. And, I've written about this in this book, The Creator and the Cosmos, also in some articles I've put up online at reasons.org under Today's New Reason to Believe. What the modified Newtonian dynamics model has going for is that it seems to explain the dynamics of certain spiral galaxies better than what we would get from general relativity and Big Bang cosmology. But that's the only thing it's got going for it. There's a number of other dynamical tests we can apply to MOND where it's not doing anywhere near as well as Big Bang cosmology and general relativity. And what I've written articles about is that, yes, MOND does give us good answers for the dynamics of these galaxies, the spiral arm dynamics of these galaxies, but there's also ways to get equally good results using Big Bang cosmology, particularly where you invoke dark matter in the right way. And so what I'm excited about with these atomic clocks is it's going to enable us to pin down the dynamics of galaxy to much higher precision, because a lot of it has to do with the positions of the different massive bodies. And so using very long baseline interferometry, we should be able, for example, it's now going to be possible to come up with a really accurate map of our Milky Way galaxy, as well as the nearby galaxies in the local group, because we're going to be able to come up with trigonometric distance measurements to virtually all radio objects, radio emitting objects. And now that we can go to the millimeter wavelengths, we're going to be able to access a lot more objects. And if I remember right, I think Karina is actually involved in millimeter radio astronomy. So I think she'd be one to be really excited about these clocks, because it's going to enable you to take literally millimeter wave radio telescopes separated by thousands of miles and be able to do long baseline interferometry. So Karina, maybe this is going to really help you in your research on exoplanetary systems. Hello? Did we lose a connection here?
It looks like we lost Ross there for a second. So you've another question. Einstein determined that that time is relative. Can the billions of years of creation event passed on based on human mind interpretation also be fractions of days in terms of God's mind? Some argue this way to find a harmony between science and scripture. What are your thoughts?
Well, Eubin is right. There's been some speculation, especially by young earth creationists, saying, well, wait a minute. God's not constrained in time the way we are. And what he's telling us is that these days in creation really are 24-hour days and that they're consecutive. But that's in God's concept, not in our concept. And Gerald Schroeder, a Jewish physicist, he's an old earth creationist, just like I am. But that's one of his arguments, is to make the point, well, you know, God could be in a different time frame than we are. And he's revised his thinking, but there's others have also made the same point and I would agree with him. You know, God created time. So he's quite free to count time very differently than we count time. But one of the things I notice is when you go to Genesis chapter 1, it says the Spirit of God is hovering over the surface of the waters of planet Earth. That seems to imply that he's telling us the account of creation in the same time frame that we exist in. So that's, if that's the frame of reference for God relating the story, then that really tells us maybe we need to look more carefully these days. But I've had the opportunity to have a dinner with Gerald Schroeder, and he's persuaded that these days, as you look at it in the Hebrew, is talking about, he kind of sees this analogy picture going on. But of the days, and we had a good talk about this, if you could actually exegetically show that these days are six consecutive long periods of time, which I'm convinced is quite doable, I've demonstrated that in my book, A Matter of Days, then there's really no need to appeal to any other kind of time frame. A relativistic time frame or a time frame beyond this cosmos that becomes unnecessary. So that's kind of my perspective on it. People have speculated that might be one way to resolve, say, young earth creationism with old earth creationism. You could have God counting the days differently than we see in the astrophysical record. But frankly, I see no need for that once we can establish that indeed there's no closure on day seven, and the events of day six clearly occur over a long period of time. And the Hebrew word per day can mean a long finite period of time. Looks like we got Ross.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. It's 11:52. I don't have any more questions on the Q&A. Mark, you seem to have access to questions that I'm not seeing. Do you have another question for you?
Yeah, hang on just a sec. Okay, the first one comes from Doug McComb, and he says, do most of the proper noun names of the Bible characters have literal meanings? And how much do you think God had anything to do with their naming?
Well, he could have, and indeed, the names that you see in the Old Testament do have meanings. Matter of fact, as a parent, I went through all these dictionaries to try to discern, okay, what is the base meaning of all these different names we could assign to our sons? And because I wanted them to actually, recognize that we had a reason for giving them the name that we gave to each one of them. And so I think that's true of all languages, but it's especially true of biblical Hebrew. And you see that when you read the Old Testament, where a father or God steps in. I mean, God changed the name for Jacob, for example. So Names do have significance. It basically gives the individual something to look up to and to pursue. So, and something I've noticed as a father, I mean, one of the things I appreciate about being in the delivery room with my wife when she was giving birth to our two sons, I was the first one that got to hold our newborn son. And it's like, even in those first few seconds, you could actually discern what kind of personality they had. I mean, my firstborn son, he was just staring at me. You know, I wasn't expecting his eyes to be as well-developed as they were, but they were. He was looking at different things in the room, very quiet, very still. And I said, you know, I think this is going to be our philosopher son. And then the second born, as soon as he came out, he was bouncing all around, very active. I was actually doing that while he was still in the womb. My wife was always saying, you know, I think I'm being beat up by our second born son. And, you know, he was all action. And so that kind of revealed a little bit about his personality. And I think that factors in to the names that parents assign to their children. But we see in the Old Testament that God often intervenes and says, no, this is the name you need to give to the son. And we see that with Jesus. His name was assigned by God himself. This is the name that you should call him.
Now, the question that follows up from Doug is, how come Christ's name was not literally Emmanuel? Why did he end up with Jesus?
Well, you know, we have different names, and you see that in the Old Testament as well, that often you get individuals that have more than one name that they're referred to. And if you actually look through the entire Old Testament, I did this once when I was much younger. I went through the Old Testament and looked up every name that's assigned to the second person of the Trinity. You want to know how many names I came up with? 88 distinct names. And each of those names is describing some attribute of the person of Jesus Christ. And so that's actually an interesting theological study to do, is look up all the names that are assigned to an individual you see in the Bible. The second person of the Trinity takes a record for 88 distinct names. God himself has different names that you see in the Bible, God the Father. And so you can learn a lot by looking at the meanings of those different words.
And then Doug follows up with, how specifically does the 1,000-year millennium end? Does Christ ascend to heaven again? Do people die at the end of the millennium? Is there a war?
Well, that is a question. I mean, I think one thing that all Bible-believing Christians believe on is that there will be a second coming of the second person of the Trinity. He is going to come back to earth. He came once a couple of thousand years ago. He's coming back. But exactly what happens when he comes back and the time sequence of what takes place after he comes back is an area of wide discussion amongst Christians. So there's a wide range of views. And it's something you see in the creeds of the Christian church is that the creeds do talk specifically about the second coming of Christ. But that's as far as they go. Recognizing that the way the Bible talks about the second coming leaves a lot of room for speculation. But clearly, when he comes back, things are going to happen, and things are going to happen immediately. He puts an end to a war that's going to be raging throughout the earth. So he comes and puts an end to that war, tells us he's coming on a horse. And the horse is a biblical symbol for conquest, which means he's going to put an end to these conflicts. He's going to establish a reign of peace. And following the second coming, there's going to be a judgment, judgment day. The great white throne judgment occurs right after the second coming. That's a time when Satan gets thrown back into hell. It's a time when the fate of the demons is sealed. And it's a time when we get taken into a new creation, where God speaks this universe out of existence and replaces it with a brand new realm, a new creation, and he will take us there. But let's open to speculation. How much time is there between the second coming of Christ and our entry into the new creation? That's not been revealed, but it seems to me, just reading what we see in the Old and New Testament, it's a relatively brief passage of time. I don't think we're looking at millions of years. I don't even think we're looking at millennia. I think we're looking at a much briefer period of time. And that fits with what I see in the physics of the Earth and our solar system. I don't see room for being much more than a millennium from actually the present moment until we get taken to the new creation. Two millennia, maybe maximum, so relatively brief period of time. But don't try to pin me down to the year or the month. I don't know.
Thank you. Our friend Juven from the Netherlands that says, Jesus said, let the dead bury the dead, to someone who said he wants to follow Jesus after burying his father. Does this have literal or allegorical meaning? Thank you.
Well, I think it's more allegorical in the sense that Jesus is saying, hey, becoming a follower of Jesus Christ is making me number one in your life. I take priority over everything else. You know, that's what a Christian's all about, where my relationship with Jesus Christ becomes the most significant relationship in my life, which means if I have to choose serving my creator over serving my father or burying my dead father, I choose my creator. Now, that doesn't mean all the times that we're going to have to reject our relationships with everyone else. After all, Christ calls us to love one another. And so serving one another is part of the mission of being a follower of Jesus Christ. But he's making the point, I need to be number one in your life. I take priority over everything else. And we see that when he called his disciples. They literally dropped from their fishing enterprise, left all their nets, their boats, and went off to follow Jesus. But we also notice once they became disciples of Jesus Christ, there were times when they went back to their fishing enterprise. But they made the point, look, this individual just showed up to us. This is so monumental and important. They literally stopped halfway through their fishing enterprise, left their boats and nets, and went to follow him. But again, Jesus is not calling us to exclusively follow him. Part of following him is serving one another and being a blessing to humanity and being a blessing to God himself. Hopefully that will help.
Okay, we have two more questions left over. They're pretty quick, so you'll be able to get into your meeting.
Well, you know what? It's noon right now. What I want to do during our discussion time where we go into meetings, so if you don't mind holding those two questions for next week, Mark.
Okay.
That'd be good, because I don't want us to go on into the rest of the afternoon here. But, you know, 2 weeks ago, it was Easter, and we talked about the evidence for the resurrection, how the cornerstone of the Christian faith is the resurrection. If Jesus rose bodily from the dead, then we have evidence that clearly he has the power to raise anyone else he wants from the dead. And that's the promise of the Christian faith. This life here on earth is a gateway to a much better life. And Christ demonstrated that he's got the power to take us there by raising himself bodily from the dead. If he can raise himself bodily from the dead, he can raise any of us from the dead. And as Paul has said, if the resurrection did not happen, then we of all people on earth are to be pitied, because we have believed a lie. And it means that we're not going to be saved from our sins. We're going to physically die here, and that will be it. And so the cornerstone of Christian faith really is the resurrection. And, you know, when we met last time, we basically went through the exercise on Easter Day. Okay, you've got an opportunity to address a question from someone who's not a believer. You guys believe in the resurrection? I don't know. What's the evidence? What's the case? Or somebody who's very dismissive of the resurrection saying, I don't believe it happened. How do we respond to that? And I know we had some really good times in our small groups 2 weeks ago. I want to hear from people who participated in that. And the rest of you want to join our discussion. How can we be better prepared in a short period of time to share the key evidences, the most persuasive evidences that Jesus really did rise bodily from the dead? And one hint I gave you 2 weeks ago. There were three lawyers in the 19th century who were not believers, they were atheists. And they said, as lawyers, we're going to put on trial the case of the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. And I won't give all the details, but they wrote a book on this where they concluded that there is stronger historical evidence for the bodily resurrection of Jesus from the dead than there is for the defeat of Napoleon at Waterloo. And keep in mind, they wrote this in the 19th century. Okay, with that, let me go back to the screen share, and I'll give you the URL one more time before we go into the meeting. Okay, this is the URL. It's the same URL we've been using for the past several months. We've now extended it a few more months. And by the way, we are making preparations to return to in-person meetings. We'll be meeting at the Reasons to Believe headquarters while Christ Church of Sierra Madre does some big remodeling of the hall we were using there for the Paradoxes class. And we'll be giving you details of that when we're ready. But this is the URL you're going to need when we depart from this webinar and go into the, the web meeting. So it's the same one we've been using before. And the key thing you're going to need are those 11 digits, 817-7508-9505. Now, when I end the webinar and start up the web meeting, you'll all be put into a waiting room, and I'll need to manually move you from the waiting room into our web meeting, where we'll launch into this discussion on the evidence for the resurrection. So with that, I'm going to stop the share feature. And I'm going to end the web meeting, and I'll see all of you who want to join us in the, not the webinar, but the web meeting.